Welcome back. In this final module, I wanted to give you some kind of cool techniques that I've put together over the last few years. Using questions early in a conversation allows the other person to feel that you are yielding control of the situation and conversation so that they can have the floor. So imagine that you're at a prestigious private school in the admissions process. You finally meet the president of the school in his impressive office. So we're here to talk about putting my son in your school. I understand that you have a very high criteria for acceptance. Can you tell me a little bit about it? Now, instead of reciting your biography, your credentials, your status in the community, the president of the school is looking at you while he explains to you who their ideal candidates and families are. Cool. All right. All of his communication is directed to you. All of his feelings about the criteria which he helped determine are projected onto you. You don't have to sell yourself. You simply have to ask the right questions. After the president of the school tells you his criteria, you simply ask, "So, what do you want to see in our family and our son?" And then he tells you. "And is there anything else?" And he tells you. Your lack of hesitation, the fact that you showed no fear, no desperation, no concern about whether your son would be accepted, is precisely what the president of the school did not anticipate seeing. His expectations are now changed. You're now sitting across the table from the girl. You've listened to her concerns about her past relationships. You have nothing that you need to tell her about yourself to set her mind at ease. You simply ask, "What would you like to see in a good relationship?" If you were at the office with your manager and you wanted approval for a budget increase to work on a marketing project, you don't try to convince the boss how amazing and cool your idea is. You simply ask him what results he would expect to see when the marketing project is complete, and then tell him how much extra money you need allocated to achieve that. The expectation that they all had about you was that you were going to try to put a big neon sign out there saying how wonderful you are. Instead, you asked specifically what their expectations of this specific situation were and silently implied that that's exactly what they would get. And if they hire you, go out with you, do business with you, that's exactly what's going to happen because that's how you're going to make it happen. That's probably the coolest technique you can use, is asking well-formed questions. These next couple of techniques are all related to a study that was done by a really big lender of money in South Africa back in 2005. And unlike most studies that are done on a college campus with adult students, this study was done with 51,000 South African recipients of a direct mail piece soliciting loans to customers who had borrowed money from the lender in the past couple of years. So these are people that they've done business with before. Now, the goal of this study was to find what caused people to respond to the direct mail marketing and what didn't. Would lower or higher interest rates promoted in the marketing piece make a difference in bringing people into the bank? What about differences that had nothing to do with the borrowing of money? The direct mail pieces sent out were subdivided in a whole bunch of different ways, which could have only been done in such a large magnitude experiment like this one, not on a college campus. They tested different interest rates ranging from 3.25% to 11.75% per month. They compared their interest rates to competitors' rates that were higher and stated so in different ways in tables. They tested for the inclusion of three different tables that showed various payments and combinations of repayment terms. The third table was a small table with one loan size, one loan term, one monthly repayment, and one interest rate. They tested for photos and similarity of last name, of letter author, of lender employees who were sending the letter, and that person's race and gender were manipulated depending on the race and gender of the person they estimated they were sending the letter to. These were guessed by the names of people that were receiving the letters. Then 10,000 people were sent letters that had no photo in the letter. as a control for that specific variable. And the offer frame was tested for several things, including a positive-negative frame. So, like, if you borrow elsewhere, okay, or from us, you will pay $100 rand more or less each month on a four-month loan. It was tested for the monthly saving, total saving frame, which is if you borrow from us, you will pay 100 rand less each month, or 400 rand in total on a four-month loan. And it was also tested for the percentage points total percent frame. If you borrow from us, your interest rate will be 4% lower versus if you borrow from us, you will pay 32% less each month on a four-month loan. Now that you kind of get the idea of what they were looking at, would you like to know what influenced people to take a letter from the mailbox to the kitchen, open it, and then take it back to the lender and talk to the lender about getting a loan? To begin with, the letters with a small table indicating one loan amount, one term, and one monthly repayment amount, and one interest rate returned better than those letters with bigger tables that included, say, four possible loan amounts and four possible repayment options. The small table was most successful. The authors of the study calculated that the table, the size of the table, and information included was so important that the interest rate offered would have needed to be 2.3% lower per month. 2.3% lower per month. Yeah. For the letters using the big tables to generate customers bringing in the letters to the lender's office for a loan. Generally speaking, the more information your client considers and the more they evaluation process time they give to it, the more information you need to give them. The less information they want, the more likely they will say no if you go into great detail. As far as how much information to give someone, here's a good rule of thumb. The more expertise the person has in a given area, the more features, but not benefits, the person needs information about to make a good decision. They're going to match your message to what they already have stored in their memory and their mind. If you come across as not knowing the actual working details of whatever your idea or proposal is, you lose. If you have quality information, you engage the client and optimize your chances of making a sale. When a person is not an expert in a certain area, less information is generally more likely to be processed more quickly and favorably. And because in this case, less is better, you want that message to be very different. You want to share benefits, not features, with the client. When the client is not an expert, peripheral cues become very important. The next discovery in that 2005 South Africa study was which offer frame results were seen to be the most effective. The study tested the offer frame in a few ways. First, the positive-negative frame, which I told you about earlier, which is if you borrow elsewhere or from us, you'll pay 100 rand more or less each month on a four-month loan. The second one was the monthly saving, total saving, the other alternative. If you borrow from us, you'll pay 100 or 400 rand less each month or in total on a four-month loan. And then the percentage point versus total percent frame. If you borrow from us, your interest rate will be 4% lower versus if you borrow from us, you'll pay 32% less each month on a four-month loan. Survey says, by far, the most profitable frame was the loss frame. Additionally, descriptions in terms of actual money were much more effective than percent or interest rates. As a technique, here's what you got to know. Create a word picture that creates a moderate amount of tension if the person doesn't connect with you or if a client doesn't do business with your company. In other words, in a selling situation, what will the client lose if they don't do business with you? People fear loss and think about it all the time. But this is different than random considerations. You are intentionally inducing the process of deframing. Deframing is more effective in some contexts than others. Consider what is potentially going to be lost and compare it to the cost of being with you or doing business with you. Loss aversion is more pronounced for safety than money. People will do more to protect themselves than their money. Loss aversion is more pronounced for income than leisure. Losing a chance to travel is not as powerful as losing income. Determine what people lose if they don't do business with you, and artfully develop word pictures that clarify the hurt they might experience if they don't. And earlier, I just shared with you an example about disability and how that could be motivating for people to buy insurance. The next technique also comes from the South African study from the bank. And if you recall, the study tested for photos and similarity of last name of letter author of lender employees who were sending the letter, and that person's race and gender were manipulated depending on the race and the gender of the recipient of the letter, guessed by the names of the people. Then 10,000 people were sent a letter with no photo as a control for this variable. This is fascinating. Photos of men caused people to stay home. Far fewer people receiving letters with photos of men came in for loans. A photo of a female employee in the letter, on the other hand, increased people coming in for a loan significantly, often by as much as the same effect as a 2.2% lower interest rate per month offering. More significantly, the letter with a photo of a female employee, when sent to men, increased the number of those coming in for a loan so much that the offer would have had to have been 4.5% lower interest rates per month to generate the same result. More significantly yet, when the med had previously taken out loans from the bank three or more times, the photo of a female had an even greater impact. Men did not positively respond to a male photo in a significant way, and only slightly less so than receiving those with no photo at all. Female customers showed no significant reaction in responding to the loan offer, whether the photo was of a man, a woman, or no photo at all. Many other influential variables were tested and reported on what's beyond the scope of this program, but you can learn more by looking up What's Advertising Content Worth? Evidence from a Consumer Credit Marketing Field Experiment 2010. That's really worth your time. Absolutely awesome, awesome material. Now, next technique. What if you're not a woman or an attractive woman? What should you do? How important is your face in selling and marketing? Should you have your photo on your business card, your website, your marketing materials? Does it really make any difference at all? Well, you should put your photo on your business card, your website, your marketing materials, your political signs, pretty much everywhere. Do everything you can to ensure that people know your face, that they are familiar with it. The brain really associates familiarity with attraction and positive feelings, so we want your face to be as familiar as possible. A recognized face is generally a trusted face, with a few exceptions, and you will compound the effect through repetition. Take these actions. Put your picture on your business card. Incorporate your photo in all your advertising so that your face becomes familiar, friendly, and trustworthy, and influential as an expert in your industry. Put a 1.5 by 1 inch photo of yourself in the upper left-hand corner of your website. In terms of spatial dynamics, that shows the service or product is not about you, but you're there to help. Insurance agents or realtors can put a black and white image at the top right of their business stationery. With a picture of your agent present, it's harder to break your relationship with the company. One of the coolest ways I've seen an image used is by a neat lady named Gina, who was in my internet marketing class in Dallas. She had a photo of her daughter embossed in her purse. Imagine the self-esteem boost to that kid. That's worth 100 love I love yous if nothing is. Another really cool technique of persuasion is to ask compliance-causing questions. When you ask anyone if they intend to take some specific action, they become more likely to follow through than if they had never been asked to. And it doesn't really matter if the person responds no or not. Your asking and their entertaining the question creates an intention that tends to remain available to higher level employees of you, the selves inside of you, until you've done the deed. Now, do understand that people ask intention questions all the time, and you don't act on all of them. You don't act on most of them, but you act on far more intention questions than you might think possible. It's just the way the brain is wired and how all the processes all interact with each other. If you ask someone, "Will you buy a Mac before Christmas?" that someone is more likely to buy a Mac than the person who asked, who was asked, "Will you buy a computer before Christmas?" The second person is much more likely to buy a computer than the person you asked nothing of. A one-second question will very probably cause them to buy a new laptop, or in the first case a Mac, much more often than you or they would have predicted. Pretty amazing. Asking one simple question, because you're not telling or suggesting, you're just asking. As soon as you buy the computer, the employee pulls the constant nagging reminders about the computer purchases, and the notion is forgotten. Now let's get more precise here. Are you going to go to dinner with me this month? You ask the question, and the other person now has a part of them in charge of making certain that she goes out to dinner with you. She may not. It might not be possible. She might be repulsed. But the nagging part of her doesn't pay attention to such things. The part's job is to make sure the outcome of going to dinner that month is fulfilled. Once the month is over, the person has indeed gone out to dinner, the nagging has ceased, the person has peace of mind again. Have you ever heard the squeaky wheel gets the grease? Human behavior is often codified with some accuracy in sayings of stories or folklore. Not always, but once in a while. As you can see, asking one question of someone can be a causal element for life-changing behavior. And you also now understand that where you don't paint a complete picture, the other person's brain has a part inside there to do just that. If you know what's likely to be drawn based on your knowledge of the individual, their behavior, their personality, their attitudes, beliefs, and simplest of ambiguous questions can generate the most profound behaviors. Carefully crafted questions have significant persuasive impact. The seventh technique I want to share with you is directing the traffic. This is a pretty cool concept. When a well-formed leading question is asked, it's usually answered without further argument. When it is answered, it leads the person one small step forward in the thought direction you're taking them. Having just experienced jury duty, I'm compelled to use this specific example. Attorneys ask leading questions to establish momentum and at the same time avoid any of the information that does not flatter their case. So, were you at the house at 8:40 p.m.? Yes. Did you have a loud argument? Yes. These are very good questions to establish facts as you see them and build momentum as you build path to the actions that you want the others to take. Too many leading questions can feel like an interrogation. The most effective way to use these to help the other person decide is to map out a set of questions and possible answers that help you cause the person to realize what they need to do next. Leading questions have been shown to actually change a memory, what a person believes he's witnessed. According to Elizabeth Loftus, the questions asked after an event, seemingly designed to help a witness recall what they remember seeing or experiencing, can actually be used and structured to introduce new information or doubt in what was asserted by the witness. This certainly is easy to use in a courtroom. Here, the prosecution can only ask questions of the witness, and it's here that very subtle differences in wording can produce shockingly different results. Let's turn back to Loftus for just a moment. In one of her experiments, and she's done a lot, after subjects were shown video of a car accident, they were asked one of five questions. How fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other? How fast were the cars going when they collided into each other? How fast were the cars going when they bumped into each other? How fast were the cars going when they hit each other? How fast were the cars going when they contacted each other? With the above question, smashed produced the highest estimated speed. The scale slides down to contacted, which was the lowest estimated speed. So realize there are different degrees of impact in each word that is used within each question. Words can matter. Some word choices are simply stronger at conveying meaning. Choose carefully as you are quite literally leading the thoughts of other people in your world. The eighth technique I want to give you today is called Do I Understand? When necessary, you want to discover precisely what their words mean to them. One trap you and I fall into is thinking that everyone has the same definition of the words we all use every day, and they don't. When we experience anything, we label it with words. Think about the last time something happened that you wanted to tell your best friend. In that moment, you're wrapping around the experience and, in effect, labeling it. Those labels are the words that mean something to you. How you define what those words mean is unique to you and might be completely different from another person who's also experienced the same event and is telling one of his friends. Differences in definition cause misunderstandings. In your communication, it's critical then to ask the right questions to help either define the situation in the manner that's helpful to you, or at the very least, question to understand how the other person is defining the event. What triggers you to ask defining questions is the feeling you get after you paraphrase and feedback what you believe they're telling you. Their reaction will give you a clue if you're on the same page. If you don't clarify right now in this moment, then that person will leave the encounter with you and say, do, or believe things that are not in line with the direction you would like them to have be moving in. For example, if the person describes the situation as overwhelming, ask, what do you mean by overwhelming? Or, how is it overwhelming? With the focus placed on the word, you're forcing a description of what overwhelming means to them. The more you understand this, the better chance you have to successfully persuade them, for sure. Listen for the words they use to describe the situation: exciting, frustrating, confusing, disappointed. Also listen for the words they use to describe how they feel about the situation: tired, frustrated, overwhelmed, overloaded, fried, baked, burnt out, encouraged, optimistic. With these two key pieces of information, how they describe what the situation means to them and how they describe how they feel about the situation, you can now begin to speak their language, lower defenses, and lead them to the best solution. Here's an example. Customer says, I just can't afford this plan, it's too expensive. You say, expensive in what way? The chances are they'll either define expensive as an unnecessary luxury, or one that's not seen as fitting with their image or status, overpriced compared to the perceived value, or it's out of their current budget. Once you have that information, you work to modify their perception of the benefits or select a more suitable alternative rational choice. Definition questions are also used to clarify items that could be an objection for you or the other person. When you need to clarify, you ask, can you tell me more about why it's necessary to involve Bob? This will get the person to clarify Bob's role and why it's important to have him on the project. The person may have been on the fence about Bob, but after clarifying his value, it cements Bob's position on the project team. A little sip of water here. Excuse me. Another goal in clarifying definitions is to use their answer as a positive lead into a clarifying statement by you. For example, you might say, if the other person didn't mention quality and you know this is critical, of all the factors you just mentioned, what about the speed is important to you? And maybe Jen says, speed's critical. It's the only factor that matters because it keeps the per price piece down, piece per price down. And then you say, so the piece, boy, this is not easy to say, is it? So the per piece price, we don't want to do that live, do we, is more important than the quality of each piece. Jen says, oh no. Quality of each piece is the most important because it doesn't matter how inexpensive each piece is if they're no good. And then you say, got it, I understand your point. Quality is the priority. And don't use a lot of peas when you're recording your best material for your new fans. Clarification of definition allows you to gently steer the focus of the other person in the direction that will keep their thoughts and actions in line with the outcomes the other person needs. Our ninth technique is pretty cool. The first shall be last and the last shall be first. Sequencing matters, but there is more to consider than just the sequence itself. When presenting an idea, lead with a statement of the benefit and the result that can be expected from what you propose. Then progress using discovery questions so that the other person is answering questions and telling you stories about why they want what you're offering. In the majority of circumstances, the options noted last is not only remembered first, but chosen or decided in the end. The next most common choice is what's offered first. It turns out that when people are in a good mood, they tend to accept what's offered to them first. When people are not in a good mood, they tend to ruminate, and all things being equal, they're more likely to choose what you present last. So, if you have the option of being one presenter of many today, you'll want to go first or last and use the above criteria for deciding when you want to speak. When is typically far more important than what or how. 10th, number 10. Our last little technique for you today is called More Than the Message. When planning the delivery of your message, remember that the outcome of the delivery is dependent on a lot more than just the message. There's context, environment, peripheral puzzle pieces. There's more of those pieces that aren't the core of the messenger's information. Nonprofit organizations will often send out attractive women to do their fundraising or recruiting in order to increase the number of people who become involved and the amount of dollars donated. When the woman makes her presentation to a group, the content of her messenger receives some attention, which will be influential on the final decision-making. But for many people in the audience, the fact that she's attractive will add dramatic weight to the decision for many, if not all, in the group. So you've selected the right environment. Influence is not only about the messenger. It's about where and how the message is being delivered. Are you in a church, a school, a playground, bar, club, office building? The same message in all those places is going to be received differently and will lead to a different decision due to the influence of the location. Pick it carefully. Who's the messenger with? When the man is walking down the hall or accompanied on a business meeting by an attractive lady, she's peripheral to him but adds great value to him. Your car. The car you arrive in has enormous impact if they see you stepping out of the car and it does not meet with their approval. Some examples. If it's a gas-guzzling vehicle, you lose if you're talking to an environmentalist. If you arrive in a minivan, you'll be meeting with a wealthy single executive. How are you going to look then? Perhaps you arrive in a Jaguar and you'll be speaking to a conservative religious family. Not so great. In all cases, the car works against the messenger, so you want to be thinking about what you're going to arrive in as well. Always think about more than just you and the other person. Everything else matters too. And if there's anything that I wanted you to really, really take home out of this program, is just that. Everything else matters. The when matters more than the what and the how, and the why matters more than all the rest of it. It has been a real pleasure meeting you and being with you today. Thanks for having me along.